Mike aligns with my moral compass, with my belief in humanity. I honestly, truly believe people are genuinely good, and that the vast majority of us, we want to live in a kind, diverse, inclusive, fair, culturally rich society, and that we want equal access for all of our kids to really high-quality education, and that we want to take care of this spectacular planet that we live on, and that we want our leaders to raise the bar. I want them to be held to a higher standard, and I want to be asked to be risen to a higher standard. And I think more than anything, I just want to have hope. I want to believe, and I want to be inspired. So it is my great pleasure to introduce you to Mike Johnson.
Thank you. I'm so honored to be here and bound to disappoint you after that introduction. I was going to tell you the story about the fantastic car accident we had on the way over here, but my mom is in the crowd and I don't want to scare her. So I will just tell you that we are delighted to be here, but we managed to hit almost all of the snowbanks on Red Mountain Pass on the way from Durango to Grand Junction. But the great thing about Colorado is you only have to be in a snowbank for like 30 seconds, and someone in a truck will come by and start helping you pull yourself out. So we got to meet 10 or 12 new voters on the Red Mountain Pass. I think, I don't know how it'll work on Gabe's car, but that as a campaign strategy seemed to have worked effectively for the last 3 hours. I do want to say a quick couple of thank yous to just start off, which is there is a number of extended family members, sort of extended family of mine here today. The Ogilvies, who helped raise me, are here. And my longtime friend, Brother Kayo, and Sister Molly are here, and who've been lifetime friends and so grateful. I was just thinking of you, Meredith, this last week, because my very favorite photo ever of my dad and I is the photo that you took of me after we lost the Cortez soccer game with my dad holding me in his arms. I have it on my desk now. So my dad passed a year and a half ago, and so the memory I keep of him is a photo that you took when I was in high school with my dad. So just a reminder of how long our friendship has been. And the second is, there's something about, you know, getting old and running for governor that makes you feel grateful about all the parts of your life that you've lived through. And as I've spent my career as a teacher and as principal, as an educator, you just find the overwhelming impact that great parents have on people's lives. And no one whom I'm more grateful than my mom, who is here today. And what's... My first and best teacher, and the person who inspired me to want to go out and change the world and made me believe that it was all possible along the way. So I'm so grateful for her to be here, and thanks to my elementary school teacher and second mom, Ms. Rapson, who drove her over. So it feels sort of like my Oscars acceptance speech. All of the thank yous are now out of the way. But that's you don't get enough chances to say thank you, I find, to the folks that you love, so I want to do it whenever I can. I'm going to, I think, just share maybe two stories about how I got into this work and about where I think we find ourselves now and where this country is and how I think we find our way out of where we are now, to your powerful statement earlier. As some of you may know, and some of you who know me for a long time certainly do, I grew up in Vail, and so my family's been on the Western Slope for about 40 years. We have a bed and breakfast my mom and dad ran since I was a kid, so I grew up roping KO occasionally into helping either clean toilets or fold laundry for a cookie in the afternoon. So we had every job in the place, from mowing the lawn and cleaning the laundry to now helping mom run the place. But really followed my family's career in education. I'm a fourth generation teacher. My mom was a teacher. My grandmother and my grandfather was a school principal. And so started my career out as a teacher and then as a school principal. And I was a school principal of a school in Thornton in North Denver, for those of you that know it. And the school that I ran there was mostly immigrant kids. About 60% of our kids were Latino, and about half of those students were undocumented. And we had worked very hard over the course of these 4 years, an amazing team of teachers, to try to take a school that had a 50% dropout rate previously and turn it into a place where kids had real access to opportunity. And after the end of our fourth year, we were so proud that we became the first public high school where 100% of our seniors graduated from high school and were admitted to four-year colleges. Which, thank you. As all the educators in the room know, there are about 1,000 stories of failure I could tell you behind that one, but that was the good news. The bad news was after we got to that stage, I was sitting in the cafeteria a week before graduation when one of my students came up to me, who was about to graduate, with tears in his eyes, saying to me, "Mr. Johnston, why did you make me do all this?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I did everything you ever asked. I came early, I stayed late, I was on student council, I applied to colleges, I got in, and you know I will never be able to go." I said, "Well, why do you say that?" He said, "Well, I'm undocumented. And this week in the state senate, the bill died that would have allowed undocumented kids to get in-state tuition. So my best friend Jeremy and I in the second grade have promised we'd go to University of Colorado together. We're both in. He's going to go and pay $2,000 a year with financial aid. I would go and pay $35,000 a year with no financial aid. And so I can't go." And right at that moment, it was like, you know, bringing your own child to raise and then seeing them just fall through a giant hole in the floor, which is there was nothing we could do at that point to help him, despite all the effort. I mean, literally, he had slept on the couches of our teachers when he was homeless for a while. We'd done everything we could. And that was the day I decided to run for the state senate. Because I felt like, if nothing else, I committed to Ulysses and to the rest of those students that we would try to pass that bill so that we could make sure those kids had a real chance. And I tell you the story because that that bill had been proposed 12 years in a row in the state legislature and had failed 12 times. And I tried to run it again the next year, and I failed also. And when we came back and talked to the kids who were there the night we failed, I looked back and saw that in the last 13 years, we had failed every single time, because there had never been a single Republican vote in favor of it. And I thought, you know, I have a lot of Republicans in my family and a lot of my friends are Republicans. I think they actually would see this issue the same way if they had a chance to meet Ulysses or my kids and saw what they were fighting for. And so I figured there ought to be a way to solve this problem. So I started traveling the eastern plains of Colorado with Republican friends who were senators and state representatives. A lot of them were farmers and ranchers, and saying, you know, if you look at these kids in your own communities, we think this is an issue you'd care about. And finally found one of my friends who was a state senator who coached a little league baseball team. And I had this conversation with him. I said, "You got 15 kids on your team. Do you know where they're all from?" He said, "Oh, yeah, I know them all." I said, "Just ask." And he went back for the weekend. They had a big tournament. Came onto the Senate floor on Monday morning, walked up to my desk and said, My shortstop is undocumented. It's been my son's best friend since first grade. Kid works hard, wants to make it, plays by the rules." He said, "I'll be a yes vote." First time in 13 years a Republican cast a yes vote on the bill, and for the first time I got to stand behind the governor when he signed it into law. I got to drive back up to the high school where I'd been principal and talk to those graduating seniors and tell them that for the first time, kind of the doors of opportunity were open to all kids. And I tell you that story because I think it's easy to believe at this moment in American politics that we're not capable of getting big things done anymore. And we're certainly not capable of getting big things done in collaborative and bipartisan ways. And that has not been my experience. My experience has been that it is possible if you have the vision to seek what you want to get done, you have the courage to fight through the hard times of it, and you have the humility to realize you don't have all the answers, and there are probably folks on the other side that agree with you if you just took the time to listen. And so for me, that brings us to kind of where do we find ourselves today and how do we find our way out of it? And there is a photograph that I have kept thinking of in the last few days when I think about where America finds itself today, which is, it's an iconic photo many of you have probably seen, but it's a photo in Little Rock, Arkansas, around the integration of Central High School from the Little Rock Nine. If you remember this photo, the nine African-American students entering Central High School. And the photograph is of Elizabeth Eckford, who's one of these nine students, and she's carrying her books, walking through a crowd of angry people yelling at her. And in this famous photo, there's a little girl, there's a high school girl that's about 14 years old in a poodle skirt, white girl, who is running up behind Elizabeth Eckford and just screaming at the top of her lungs into Elizabeth Eckford's ear. And you don't see on the transcript, but you can tell what she's saying, and it's kind of unimaginable that how did this girl who should have been in a sock hop somewhere find her way into this street screaming at Elizabeth Eckford. And it felt like America at its worst when you saw that photo. I think the rest of the country saw that and said, wow, how did we end up here? And I think there are three reasons we end up there, because that's, I think, how it feels right now if you look at what the last year has felt like. I think one of the reasons is that there was so much economic change happening so quickly that people were so afraid of They didn't know how to cope with that economic and cultural change. The second thing was they began to lose faith that their public institutions were going to be any part of solving that problem. And when you have that tremendous fear, you don't have that faith that anyone is going to help solve the problem. What we do in the end is we turn on each other and we become our worst selves, as you see in that photo. So for me, the question was not how do you win a campaign, but how do you try to put together a movement to actually solve that problem? And I think you try to rebuild the things that were broken in that photograph, which is one, is you give people a chance to reconnect to each other in a way that reminds them why they cared about each other in the first place. Which means for us, one of the first things we've started doing is we have begun a project that we're calling Service Days, which are we invite Coloradans of all stripes from every background to come out and just work together on service projects that they think are meaningful. We're rebuilding a destroyed community garden in an elementary school in Arvada this Saturday for our first one. People, it's not campaign waving, it's not flag, it's not door knocking, it's not canvassing, it's just service around things that we all think are important, shoulder to shoulder on issues that affect all of us. We're hosting family dinners in all these small communities where we travel, where it's 15 people together at a dinner table, not all Democrats, five or six Democrats, five or six Republicans, five or six independents, literally back to a dinner table where we can talk again about what the things are that combine us. Then as we're traveling the state, staying wherever we go in the houses of people that will let me crash on a couch or in a spare bedroom to begin to talk to them about what they're facing, what their stories are, and how we can share them. After you reconnect people again, then the question has to be, okay, can you rebuild some faith that we can solve problems together? And so what we're doing that's different is we're going to try to build local leadership teams in all 64 counties who help identify and solve the problems that they think are most important in those regions that the state ought to take action on. So instead of having one centralized campaign infrastructure in Denver that says, you know, sort of Moses coming down from the mountaintops with the two stone tablets to say, here is our plan to solve energy, we're going to engage in each local county our own teams of policy leaders and communications leaders and canvassing directors and data and technology experts to say, what are the most important issues here and how do we communicate with other counties that grow their own leadership teams to solve those problems? And then the third is we're going to try to address how do you fix the fundamental economic fear that I think has had a big impact in the country in the last year and a half. And for us, that means how do we become the first state that actually comes up with a system to get ourselves ahead of the rate of economic change instead of feeling like we're being dragged behind the old economy. I think the last year felt a little bit like, you know, they came first for the coal miners, but I was not a coal miner, so I said nothing, right? Which is automation and globalization is transforming every part of the work that we do. And some industries are affected most quickly, but all of us will be affected eventually. And the question is, how do we prepare people to have the skills they need for the jobs that emerge when those changes come? So this is why we proposed what we call the Colorado Promise, which is the opportunity for anyone at any stage in their career, whether it's an 18-year-old or a 58-year-old, to get up to 2 years of either skills training or community college debt-free in exchange for providing some service to the state. So nothing's free in Colorado. You have to work for it. But we believe what we want is to invest in those people to develop those skills for the industries that are emerging. So you can take folks in coal plants in Route County that are closing and prepare them with the skills they need to work in the wind tower factories in Pueblo that are opening, because those things are both happening right now, but we don't have a system to connect those old skills to the new skills. So that's how we've tried to address solving the actual problem. The ending of the story is if you go back in history, there is actually great hope in that traumatic photograph of Elizabeth Eckford and Hazel Bryan, which is the end of this story, is that Hazel Bryan, the white girl, leaves this small town, moves to Arkansas, gets a job, gets married, has two or three kids, discovers that the world is going to continue on without the greatest fear she had about what Central High School faced. And when that fear gets alleviated, she decides to flip through the white pages and she finds Elizabeth Eckford's phone number. And she calls her and says, I just want to tell you that I'm sorry for who I was that day. And I'm wondering if you'd meet me for a cup of coffee. Elizabeth Eckford says, yes, I will. And they sit and they have one cup of coffee. They decide to go on a second date and they have a second cup of coffee, and a third and a fourth and a fifth, and they actually become friends. And out of this friendship, they decide, you know what, we have the power to do something to change what we live through. And they decide to write a book together. And they then travel high schools around the country with that book and open every talk with that photograph of the two of them behind them and say, yes, this is who we were then, but this is who we are now. And this is how we got from where we were to where we are. There is no doubt we are going to have to answer to our kids and our grandkids for who we have been over the last year. The question is, what story will we empower ourselves to write over the next decade so we'll have the chance to be proud of telling them about who we have become? I think that is the question that awaits for Colorado right now. And if we can do that here, it doesn't just change the plight of one state. I think it proves to the other 49 there's a way out of this that doesn't involve us having to tear each other apart. So that's why I got into this race. That's why I'm here tonight. That's why I'm so grateful that you're here also. Thank you so much. And I'm happy to jump into taking questions, which is the most important part of the night.
It sounded like throughout your political career, you've done a lot to bring people with opposing views together. And you don't seem like a very scorched earth kind of candidate. I agree with you. I think that that's really what we need to do is listen to each other, respectful discourse, etc. What would you say to people that really want to go negative? You know, how would you counteract their argument? What's your argument against going negative and for, you know, the things that you described, sitting at a dinner table, whether it be real or metaphorical, with independents, Republicans, etc.?
Great question. I think there's a moral answer to that question, and I think there's a practical answer to that question. Right? I think the moral answer to the question is I still tend to believe that there is more good in other people than not, which is I don't think ever assuming the worst about them as the leading characteristic gets us very far. The practical part is even if you don't believe that, if you just want to get things done that you care about, in a state like Colorado, you can't get things done that you care about with one party. The Democratic Party is 30% of this state. Independents are 30%, Republicans are 30%. You don't have to know a lot of math to know you can't get to 50% on anything with one party. What I found is, you know, the reason why, you know, that Republican was willing to be the first guy to stand up and vote on the Dream Act that I described was there had been times where there were issues that were important to him that I was willing to be the only one to stand up on my side because I thought he was right. And so I thought that faith, and it wasn't because I did it because a year later I thought I'd need his vote, I had no idea. It was the relationship that we built that said, if I think you're right, I'll stand up and say that you're right. And there are times when he thought I was wrong and he'd say that too. But I think, and I just think, I don't think the strategy of looking out at the 52, 55 million people who voted on the other side of the last election and deciding that they're somehow diametrically opposed to all the things that I care about, it doesn't feel true to me. It doesn't, you know, I have folks that voted that way in my own family, in my own block, in my own neighborhood, and I find them to be far, far better than that estimation. It's just a matter of the work I have to do to refine what the things are that we agree on. And so the learning about the service days came for me from after the election. My next-door neighbor was a big Trump supporter. We'd been friends for a while. You know, he's an Army Ranger, conservative guy, but we'd been friends. October was kind of a tenuous month on our block, right? We didn't see each other quite so much. And the old car that I have that has now died in Rifle about a month ago, I had lost a fender, predictably, and so I had to put a fender back on. And so my strategy was, you know what? I'm going to go knock on Josh's door. I'm not great at car repair. Josh was. I just knocked on his door on the Saturday after the election and said, hey, I have a six-pack of beer and a broken fender. Like, would you help? You know. And we spent 2 hours in my driveway fixing the fender, talking about all the things that weren't the election. And I remembered all the things I loved about him, right? He's a good dad. He's a good husband. He's a good man. Like, served our country. All sorts of great things that it was easy for me to forget through the month of October. So I found as many chances as we can create to give ourselves the excuses to rediscover that, it kind of refills the tank to give you the strength to fight on the hard stuff. But I think now we're in a place where you got to refill the tank. You bet. Other questions? Yes, ma'am.
I have a question about a bill that you authored called Senate Bill 191.
Yes.
In our valley, we have recently, are currently constructing a new school, which has displaced a lot of teachers from another school. And these teachers are looking for a mutual consent position in order to continue their employment. But they are doing so without a lot of feedback about why they were displaced, and they are also rated effective under SB 191. Mm-hmm. So my question is, was that your intent with that law? And if not, how would you change it?
And let me just ask one clarifying question so I understand the context. So there's one school that is downsizing, that is reducing staff, and then there are, and those teachers are now looking for positions someplace else.
Mostly one, definitely two.
Okay. So can I give other folks a quick summary so they know, because you obviously understand this in great depth. For the folks that don't, this is a piece of legislation called Senate Bill 191, which is about what we call the Great Teachers and Leaders Bill, which is about supporting teachers and principals and giving them evaluations to identify how they're improving their practice, and then making some changes to how people hire teachers and release them. It used to be under the old system, you could only release someone based on years of experience, not based on effectiveness. So if you were a third-year teacher, but you were the best teacher in the building by your evaluations, you had to release, you know, you'd get teachers who could be third-year teachers who would get Teacher of the Year awards and get released the next day because of their junior status. And so the idea here was that seniority still matters. It's just only second to effectiveness. On the mutual consent component, what mutual consent says is simply if there are teachers that are without a position, school closes, they get released, and they have what we call tenure in the old system, those folks, it used to be if you were a principal or a teacher, they would get forced placed into other schools, which would mean if you were a principal or a hiring team and you interviewed for a candidate and you found the best candidate and you called the central office and said, we want to hire Susie, they would say, well, we already have this other candidate who can't find a job. We're going to place them in your school, even if that teacher doesn't want to go there and the team doesn't think she's the best fit. So all we said is it has to be the decision of the principal and of at least two teachers. The law requires that teachers have an input in that decision to interview candidates and decide who's best for the job. So the only requirement under the bill is it does require that those teachers get a priority hiring interview. So whoever gets displaced must get a priority hiring interview. And there must be teachers and a principal who get to make the decision of are they the best candidate for the job. And if they don't get hired this year, so they end up off the rolls for a year, if they get rehired next year, all of their same years of experience and benefits return. So the requirement here was just to say all the people that get hired have earned their position because they're the best candidate. I think that was the intent. What I've found as a person on the principal's hiring circuit is that it's very hard to find effective veteran teachers on the job market, and so I tend to find they get snapped up pretty quickly. I don't know the dynamics here. But what we found in other places is when there are folks who get displaced, if they are effective under the new system and they have experience, they tend to go pretty quickly. But I don't know the local context about that. So my hope is if they're effective teachers, they don't get hired here, I have about 100 other schools who would probably like to take them, so we can connect you. But the goal was have teachers and principals have a say in getting to hire the people that work next to them. That was the only design. Yes?
I have a climate change question.
Great.
So I'm just curious from your perspective, what kind of concrete actions you would work towards to implement right here in Colorado to slow down climate change?
Right. So I think, and I would say, I mean, I want to balance to your earlier question. There are also certain things that I would not compromise, right? So I believe in collaboration. I also don't believe in compromising core values. So I don't believe in waiving methane gas capture rules at the federal level that allow you to flare methane gas in the environment and not capture it. That's why we passed legislation here to do it. If Trump repeals it at the federal level, we got to protect it here. So as you know, I think there's a lot of things we're going to have to play defense on the environmental front over the next 2 to 4 years. And these are places where the governor's race is the most important bulwark against that, because whether it's methane rules or river and stream protections or public lands that get released from federal control to state control, that's all going to be in the governor's capacity to protect. So I think there's some really important things to play on defense. On offense, on the things to protect climate change are, I think we need to move dramatically towards a broader portfolio of renewable energy. So I supported the mandated increase to 30% of our energy now coming from wind and solar. I think that can be expanded significantly. I think, because you sound like an energy policy wonk, I also think there's really important work to do on what we call decoupling the utility grid, which is right now your utility company works on a simple system, which is the more electricity you use, the more money they make. Which means it's in their benefit to have you use as much electricity as possible. There is a way that some states have tried to reverse that, which is you make it in the best interest of the utility company to make more money when you use less electricity. And so what they're doing is instead of trying to encourage you to keep the lights on when you're asleep at night, they're trying to constantly push you to cut your energy use. And so I think that is a really important step that we could do. I also think there's significant expansion of, I mean, one of the biggest impacts on climate change are vehicles. And so the more that we can do to move towards electric vehicles and electric fleet vehicles is really important. I sponsored legislation last year to expand and simplify the electric vehicle tax credit. So it's now a one-time point-of-sale $5,000 credit you can assign right there, and you don't have to file any papers or... It's not like the phone version where, like, they try to give you the credit, but you have to send 17 pieces of paper back at 14-day increments over 2.5 years, and you never get it. So I think those are the big three I would think about are expanding the renewable portfolio, sort of the grid changes and the decoupling, and also expansion of renewable modes of travel.
My mom lives in Longmont, and I was quite applauding when Longmont was saying, no, you can't frack in the borders of the city. Mm-hmm. And then the state said, oh, no, Longmont, you can't do that. In this valley, we just fought a big fight over Thompson Divide. And part of that for us is, of course, that's our watershed.
Yeah.
Fracking fluid goes into our water table and into what we drink. And we're not with the guy on TV who... drank the fracking fluid. I'm not going there. So I'm really upset about the state overruling cities that want to control the quality of what goes on in their borders. So talk to me about local control and fracking.
The one upside to note of natural gas, as you know, is when we look at climate change, one of the reasons we've been able to move away from coal, you know, we've voted to close down many of the coal plants in Colorado is because natural gas is a better, what we call, bridge fuel to expand wind and solar. And so for people that aren't energy junkies, if you want to have wind or solar on your grid, it's fantastic. The challenge is if the sun goes down and you have a solar energy supply, what is your backup supply? And used to be that was coal, which was very dirty and hard to turn on and off. The benefit of gas is you can turn it on and off as quickly as the sun goes on or off. And so it's a much better partner fuel. So that's why I think natural gas expansion has been important in some ways to support renewable energies. I'd like to see it be much more aggressive expansion of renewables. That's the good side. The downside is what you've described. And so I think there should be real limits to where and how we drill and frack. And I think there are three examples. One is you shouldn't obviously drill in places that are environmentally sensitive, like the Thompson Divide is the classic example of where we shouldn't be drilling. I think the second is we also shouldn't be drilling in places that are geologically unstable. So if you look at, I just looked today at an earthquake map of Oklahoma, which is astonishing because they're drilling into layers of sandstone that are highly unstable and you get earthquakes. So I think you don't want to drill in those places. I think the third is you have to figure out in the Broomfields and in the other metro areas, you know, how you have what separation you have from residential settlements, you know, residential developments. And right now there's been a big battle about how far the setbacks are. I think there is the pushback has been the Supreme Court has said you need to have one statewide set of regulations, which is the current law. I think that still gives us a chance with the Oil and Gas Commission to look at renegotiating what should the terms of those setbacks be and should you take into account how close they are to residential developments. Because I think that's, I would say, environmental protections, sort of geological safety, and human contact ought to be the three areas to push more aggressively on resettling that. Thank you for the question.
For this particular question, let's make the assumption that Trump Care 2.0 becomes law of the land sometime between now and 2018. That means...
Hypothetical is getting tougher already.
Yeah, well, I didn't say it was going to be an easy question.
Yeah.
Under that circumstance, we're talking about Medicaid becoming a per capita or state block grant. We're going to lose probably about 25% of our Medicaid funding in a taper state. So it's going to be really difficult to make up the shortfall. Garfield County, where I live these days, and if you're 60 years old, your advanced premium tax credit is going to probably be dropped by 56 to 70%. And I really am curious to know if that bill passes. What does Colorado do about that as a state, and what specifically can you do about that trend in the governor's office?
Would anybody else like this question? This is the phone a friend option. It has been, the hard part about this is it's been like one of those teenage choose your own adventure novels. It's like you have seven different versions of what could happen, and you have to build five or six eventualities on each of those. And I just thought in the last week we had gotten over door number two, which was the Obamacare repeal. And then what the version. So I'll give you a short answer because it's a very complicated question. And the short answer, as you know, is there are all sorts of scenarios based on what they repeal, how big the block grants are, how much they can support. But we know one of the immediate possibilities are you see a bunch of rural Colorado hospitals close or be able to no longer provide care to people that are in those regions. And as you said briefly, but it's important mentioning to folks who don't do this for their day job like you, that he mentioned we're in a Tabor state. So the difference is in any other state when this happens, so Kansas, for instance, the state of Kansas just voted, Republican Kansas, to expand Medicaid statewide. And they're going to fund it at their legislature because they know there are folks that need Medicare or Medicaid and they want to provide it for them. We are the only state of the 50 that could not do that because our legislature does not have the power to raise any revenue. And so when the federal government cuts, call it $500 million of Medicaid funding to Colorado, there is no backstop in Colorado. And there is no, okay, you know, legislators have to take a hard vote, and we'll have to vote to increase taxes, but we hate to do it. We're not capable of doing that under our Constitution. The only thing you could do would be go to the voters on a referendum under Tabor to have you vote to allocate new tax dollars. As someone who has tried that before and lost, I will tell you, the voters in Colorado have never once in our history voted to do that on a general tax. They don't even ever voted to tax as marijuana and cigarettes. So this is I don't want to give you any indication this is an easy problem. This is a very profound one. Because if that happens, our choices are either you drop those people off of Medicaid coverage in huge numbers. It's 407,000 Coloradans right now that are under that Medicaid expansion. Or you go to the taxpayers and ask them to vote for a tax increase to cover it. That at the same time, you're going to have to decide whether to go to the taxpayers and ask them to cover an increase of taxes for transportation funding, and we want to go to ask them for a tax increase to support education funding. So pick your billion-dollar hole. You have a $1 billion hole in transportation, a $1 billion hole in K-12, potentially a $500 million hole in healthcare. So this is a profound challenge. I think the two options we'd be left with is significantly reducing the amount of care that was available to those folks, because we'd have to move resources to prop up those rural hospitals from closing. Otherwise, you'd have people that face a two-hour drive to a hospital, and that's untenable. And so the state, I think, would morally have to do something to prop those rural hospitals up, which means cutting services to folks in the urban areas unless you get a tax expansion passed. So I generally have an optimistic outlook on life. This is one that is worrisome to me because the combination of their repeal and our state constitution would create a very difficult situation for us. I think what it would probably be is back to the drawing board on what a statewide exchange would look like with not much federal support, and how do you create a new, you know, risk-sharing structure. So we would be calling you for help.
I'll give you my number.
Good. Any other easy questions that folks would like to throw out? I'm kidding. Hard questions are fine. Yes?
Ask a question about Tabor.
So my thought is, and I joke briefly, but I... helped run a ballot initiative 3 years ago called Amendment 66, which was designed to try to fill the billion-dollar hole that we have in the K-12 system. And I like to say it was only the second worst defeat of that year because the Broncos' 40-point loss to the Seahawks in the Super Bowl was slightly more embarrassing. Ours was just slightly less bad than that. But like, taxpayers clearly said we don't want to raise taxes to fund schools statewide. And so what I learned from that is I think it's going to be very hard to pass a tax increase statewide, even if we need it. I think the best opportunity is to say under Tabor, what you could do is change Tabor to allow the state to keep the revenue that comes in under the current tax structure, which is no new taxes, no tax increases. But what that would allow is as the economy recovers, right? We have one of the fastest growing economies in the country right now. But the problem is, as that economy recovers, the budget never recovers with it because you just have to refund that money when you get over a certain level. So it's sort of on the bad years, you do worse, and on the good years, you do only slightly worse. And so I think that the key would be, could you ask the voters to allow us to keep the provision of Tabor that says you get to vote on tax increases? I don't think that will ever go away. But change the ability that says that you have to artificially limit the scale of growth and say what tax revenue generates you can keep, and on good years you can save for bad years, but not ask for an increase. I think that would help us begin to solve the problem. It won't be a one-time big infusion, but I don't think that we're going to pass at the state level something to solve the problem all in one sweep. If there's the other short-term solution, there's no chalkboard, I would do a little teachable moment, but the other short-term solution is what's called the hospital provider fee, which is, just quickly, because I think this is important, although pardon the sort of wonky details, but you'll read about this in the paper, so you know what it means if you don't already, is there is this strange structure of state government where, this is why it's extra frustrating on Medicaid, because our hospitals in our state actually got ahead of this problem and said, you know what, we know the Medicaid expansion is coming, and we know we're going to have to be able to support that, so let's create a fund to do it. And to their credit, the hospital said, we'll all throw some money in the bucket. And what we'll do is we'll all throw money in the bucket through this fee, and all that money will pool, and whenever hospitals get the most Medicaid recipients, they take the most out. And whenever they get the least, they take the least out. So it's like a shared fund for hospitals to cover Medicaid. So after the expansion went away, we would have a fund. But the federal dollars are the match to that. And so if this disappears, you lose the federal grant, the whole thing falls apart. But the problem was when they created that fund, they put that fund in the state treasury. And so we can't spend a single dollar. We can't touch it. We can't use it to pay a teacher or build a road or run a prison. But it counts as state revenue. And so under Tabor, what that does is it artificially elevates the spending limits. So I use the example of take a cup. And imagine if you had a cup. And that cup is what the state needs to fund all of its services. Tabor takes a knife and cuts a hole an inch from the top of the cup. Right? So whenever you put, no matter how much water you pour in, the economy can take off. Once it gets to an inch from the top, it's always going to pour out. Doesn't matter how much you pour in. What the hospital provider fee did is took a giant ice cube and dropped it in the middle of the cup, right? Which made a 2-ounce cup now look 4 ounces full, because that's money that we can't touch, but it's in there. And so all we said was take the ice cube out of the cup, is what's calling removing the hospital provider fee from the state revenue. But we've had Republican opposition to not get. We actually have Republicans who will vote for it. Moderate Republicans will vote for it. Republican leadership won't let it come to a vote on the Senate floor. But that change alone would put about $400 million back into the state budget without a single change to the Constitution. So that's money you're all going to get back in $14 tax refunds a year and a half from now. But if we could get that passed, that would be a short-term solution. The long-term solution, I think, would be constitutional change. One last thing is, this same thing happened 10 years ago, and a courageous, moderate governor named Bill Owens, who was a Republican, looked at this problem and said, oh, wait a sec, because you know the same thing that happened before was college tuition. If you had a kid that goes to CU Boulder, when you wrote that tuition check, it also came first to a pot in the state treasury where we held it, repackaged it, and sent it to Boulder. But it also counted as state revenue. So in the same way, the tuition dollars were blowing out the state budget. So Bill Owens said, this is silly. Let's take this ice cube out of the cup. So we already did that once for tuition. It made sense. It's the same problem with hospital provider fee. We just can't get progress on it yet. So that would be the short-term answer. Yes?
It's one of the problems that they say Obamacare has is a reduction in providers. Why we can't pass something that requires insurance providers to accept, say, 10% of their insured people as ACA people? Like, why can they just do whatever they want and let the whole program die when we could maybe help providers stay in the market?
Just to make sure I understand, why can't we mandate providers to actually take folks off of the exchange?
Right.
You might know the answer to that. I think this was debated in ACA, and they stepped back from it because they thought it was politically controversial.
Well, it's not only politically controversial, but it's also, it's not just politically controversial, it's also a legal nightmare. Because you're basically talking about requiring insurance companies to not adjust a provider network or that type of thing. You run into huge legal issues with it. And the trick is, I'm not 100% sure that doctors can actually say, I'm sorry, we're not going to take it because you got insurance through an exchange. Where the real issue would happen would be is if that particular insurance company had a provider network where it simply didn't allow that, or you couldn't go to the doctor that you wanted to, or those doctors wouldn't take certain kind of patients. So I think mostly the legal issue. That's off the top of my head if I understood the question.
It's That's why you need help to be able to do stuff like this. The only thing I would add to that is that this is also one of those places where folks that wanted to repeal Obamacare when Obama was still in office couldn't repeal it. What they did was try to find ways to cut the legs out from under it whenever possible. And so in a lot of these places, what they did is cut the funding for the reimbursement rates to providers, especially in high-cost markets. So what it meant is they would say, is that if you took folks off of the exchange or off Medicaid, you provided a dollar of services and got $40 of compensation, or 40 cents of compensation. And so a lot of hospitals simply said, we can't survive at those rates. And so I think this is also one of those places where if you want to, in goodwill, make the exchanges succeed, you got to provide the revenue source to solve them. I think that's one of the reasons why we've had a shortage of providers in the Western Slope and why we have premiums that are so high still, as we need the ability to have more competitive markets. Yes.
What do you think about the idea of a one rating region? In other words, Colorado has 9 rating regions, and yep. we're in 9, the highest.
Yep.
And to me, it seems like it would make sense if an insurance company is going to offer to the lucrative Front Range that they ought to be able to offer over here as well.
I think that this is an interesting idea. The idea that I am a little bit more compelled by right now is one of the problems you have in this rating region is you have a small number of high-cost patients where it's harder to spread their cost across a smaller population, right? And so what you get is, you know, if you're in Metro Denver and you have 100 high-cost patients, you have 1 million people to spread them across. And so I think one option I've looked at and talked to some hospital executives about is you could keep the separate rating regions, but you could create one statewide region, rating region for all of the high-cost patients. And those high-cost patients, instead of being subsidized all by their own region, would be subsidized by all 9 regions together. So what it would do is it wouldn't put you in the same pool as Denver. What it would do is take your most expensive patients that are right now driving up your premiums and make folks in Denver and Grand Junction and Denver and in Fort Collins and in Boulder spread the cost of those people more broadly. And so I think the single rating region is a little more complicated because there are different costs of living. But I think what you could do is solve some of that by taking the most expensive people and spreading their costs statewide.
And Mike, I think your campaign's asking maybe a couple more questions, and then I understand you'll be available to
mingle. Yes, love to. Love
Can
to.
I ask a question?
Please.
While I'm standing. Can you talk a little bit about what the election cycle looks like in the primary and just what happens from here forward?
Sure. Some people say it feels like the last election just ended. How can the next one be starting already? It's about a little more than a year until the primaries. This will be an unusual governor's race in our lifetime that there will be contested primaries on both sides. There'll be 4 or 5 Republicans running. There'll be 4 or 5 Democrats running. Normally you have an incumbent who's running for re-election or a lieutenant governor or something running. So this one will be unusually full. But the reason why we started early is because we wanted to be able to have as many of these conversations as possible, which is can you spend the time to be in Salida yesterday or in Durango last night or in Grand Junction this morning to sit in rooms and hear feedback from people that gives you the chance to have more substantive conversations. So we started early for just this reason. I think there'll be probably 2 or 3 other Democrats in the race, all people who I like and think are good human beings. There's a congressman from West Denver named Ed Perlmutter who I think will run. There's a former state treasurer, a woman named Carrie Kennedy, who I think will run. There's a businessman named Noel Ginsberg from East Denver, who I think will run. So I think there will be good people in the race on both sides. For us, the calendar is we will spend as much time as we can doing these smaller conversations. This is quite a large conversation, actually, thanks to you. Engaging people in a first round of conversation, then coming back and beginning to develop local leadership teams that will begin to meet on their own to discuss in each of our communities what the major issues are and connect to our leadership teams in each of the other towns and counties. So we're going to build kind of a statewide movement infrastructure to help to empower local leaders to get their voices raised so that you have a voice in informing what the major policy issues are that we take point on and how we help get them done. So we'll be doing a lot of traveling and outreach over the next year and a half, and then the primary is next June of 2018, and then the general election is November. So it's about a year to a year and a half. And believe it or not, this is sort of par for the course. Most statewide races are launching around this time of the year. Other questions? Yes?
What when you're not out campaigning right now,
yeah.
what is it you do? Are you in political office now?
Thank you. I've been in the state Senate for the last 7 years, but the legislature is a part-time job, so I've always had a day job or three along the way. And so my term ended in January, so I'm not currently in the legislature. And so I still have a nonprofit that I run, which is a program that we run that helps young people who want to be involved in social justice get involved in their leadership in their communities through nonprofits or through public office or through education. And so we run this nonprofit in nine cities around the country where we bring a lot of teachers and a lot of law students, business students, grad students interested in getting involved in social justice. We run an eight-week summer fellowship for them in nine cities. So I still run that as my day job. And then we run a if you're familiar with the Harlem Children's Zone, we run a collective impact project in North Park Hill, which is the community I represent, which you may have seen in the press last night. We had a couple of shootings last night, which is a big disappointment. We've been fighting hard to slow that down. And so we also lead a little collective impact project there, which is about bringing mental health and hospitals and educators and economic development groups all together to build towards community-based change over time. And so I still lead those two projects when I'm not campaigning. And I help raise three kids, and I coach the under 8-year-old Titans flag football team. Which you will be happy to know we made it to the semifinals last year, so we're hoping for a big, big return season this year. As Kayo can tell you, I know nothing about football, so I have no qualification of any sort.
Awesome.
Statement end on than my flag football?
Yeah, I could talk football. Oh, let's talk football. Okay. No, on that note, I guess just help me in giving a huge round of thanks, and then Mike will be available for that.